From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. This hour, as the 2012 caucus campaign season gets underway, we ask, what role do the Iowa caucuses really play in nominating candidates for president? We'll talk about how Iowa came to hold this coveted first-in-the-nation caucus position and what it takes for candidates to win in this state. My guests, University of Iowa political science professor Carolyn Talbert and former UI professor David Redlosk. Their new book, Why Iowa, examines the Iowa caucuses. Then later, we'll talk about polling, how they're conducted, and their influence on voters. That's all coming up this hour, right after the news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, it's right around the corner. Are you ready for it? The caucus campaign season is beginning in earnest, culminating in that big day just over a year from now. A day when Iowans gather in school gymnasiums, other community buildings, even homes. A day when the nation's eyes turn to Iowa. This hour, we want to examine the Iowa caucuses, their history, their significance, the strategies various candidates have used successfully and unsuccessfully to win our state. My guests for this first half hour and on to the second, as a matter of fact, the authors of a new book titled Why Iowa? How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. Joining us, Carolyn Talbert, professor of political science at the University of Iowa, and David Redlosk, professor of political science now at Rutgers University, director of the Rutgers Eagleton Poll, former professor at the University of Iowa. Carolyn and David, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Hi, Ben.
Hi. We want to reach out to our listeners during this hour. What are your thoughts on Iowa's lead-off caucus status? Do you think it's fair that Iowa gets to go first? Do you think it's good for the presidential nominating process? 1-866-780-9100 is our toll-free number. 1-866-780-9100. Or our email, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPRTalk. David, let me start with you. In the book, it's written, the Iowa caucuses have been a source of fascination, disdain, excitement, and frustration from the very start. Would you take us back to the early 1970s when a fateful decision was made that gave birth to these very significant Iowa caucuses?
Yeah, sure. You know, the caucuses, we've begun to kind of take it for granted that they're first in the process. But in fact, before 1972, that just wasn't the case. The caucuses themselves go back essentially forever. They've been how the parties organized themselves in Iowa. But after the disastrous 1968 Democratic National Convention, the riots on the streets of Chicago, the Democrats took a look at their system and, you know, we've got a problem here. We need to open it up. And in doing so, they put in place a batch of new rules, one of which had the unintended consequences of making Iowa first. And that rule was essentially that there must be public notice and at least 30 days between any event or before any event leading to the election of National Convention delegates. Prior to that, these caucuses didn't have to be advertised. They could be kind of held quietly and so on. So that new rule in 1972 essentially pushed the Iowa caucuses into late January, much earlier than they'd ever been held before, and leapfrogged New Hampshire. No one planned it. It wasn't intended to be that way, and, you know, no one paid a whole lot of attention except the George McGovern campaign, and perhaps not unconnected. McGovern was chair of the commission that set the new rules.
So there was really, in the early 70s, 1972 or shortly thereafter, there was little or no awareness that this would place Iowa on such a national political pedestal.
No, that's right. And even in 1972, it didn't have that much effect. McGovern really didn't campaign in Iowa. And while there was some media attention, it wasn't significant. But 1976 rolls around, and the Jimmy Carter campaign takes a look and says, hey, no one knows who we are, a little-known governor from Georgia. Maybe if we can go into this first thing and create some buzz, create some awareness, people will pay attention to us. And that's exactly what happened. The Carter campaign organized for the caucuses, and he came in second behind uncommitted. Mm-hmm. But in coming in second, the national media paid some attention to the guy, and he rode that momentum to the nomination, ultimately to the White House.
David Redlawsk, let me turn to Carolyn Tolbert and have her pick up the story. So the caucuses achieved their significance today through that 1976 caucus, what else happened that made them achieve the significance they have today for us?
Why Iowa actually argues that the Obama campaign in 2008 had parallels to the Carter campaign of 1996, and that both of them very successfully organized in Iowa and used the caucus system to propel their momentum onto the national stage. And as Dave says, doing better than expected in Iowa attracts national media attention, and with national media attention attracts campaign donations and money, which is critical for these candidates to win. So Why Iowa, our book, makes a couple of different important arguments. And one of those is that it's not winning in Iowa that matters as much as doing better than expected by the media. So candidates, as Dave just mentioned, Carter came in second to uncommitted or undecided in 1996, and yet he still beat the odds. And coming out in doing better than media expectations was critical in his momentum. We actually use data over a 30-year time period, and we look at the change in media coverage that candidates receive before and after the Iowa caucuses. And we show that candidates who do better than expected in the Iowa caucuses receive a greater amount of media attention. Mm-hmm. And this is very important in terms of how well they do in the New Hampshire primary and then in presidential primaries nationwide. So not just Carter, not just Obama in 2008, but a real pattern of a media game coming in and out of Iowa and doing better than the odds. The other thing that Why Iowa shows is that there actually has been a distinct change, and Iowa has become more important in the last decade with the rise of new information and the information age and online
media. The media, the 24/7 news cycle.
The 24/7 news cycle and the internet.
So why would that be?
So the saying in New Hampshire is that Iowa picks corn, New Hampshire picks presidents.
Right.
And so why Iowa argues that actually Iowa picks presidents. New Hampshire picks presidents too, but Iowa picks presidents.
Yeah, you know, Ben, historically, after Carter, Iowa appeared actually not to play a substantial role in winning the nomination. What the conventional wisdom was that winning Iowa didn't win you the nomination, but failing to do well in Iowa, based on expectations, was a guaranteed loser. Mm-hmm. So Iowa was seen as not defining who would win, but defining who would lose. Well, the New Hampshire primary seemed to play a bigger role in who would win. And I think, as Carolyn's pointing out, that has shifted over the last three election cycles to where Iowa's role appears to become much more important. And we think that has a lot to do with the ability of people to pay attention to what's going on in the middle of the country because of this 24/7 news cycle and because of the internet.
Let me ask you to comment on what it takes to run a successful campaign in Iowa, because a lot of what Iowa does is to defend its first in the nation status here against people who will detract from that. And what makes it different than other places where primaries or caucuses are held? David?
Well, the first thing is that it is, in fact, a caucus. And the second thing is that it's first. And what I mean by both of those, caucuses are different from primaries. Obviously, Iowans understand this, that, you know, in a primary, you go into the voting booth, you cast a ballot, and you're done. In a caucus, you get up, you know, out of your easy chair on a cold winter night and meet with, a few hundred of your closest friends and neighbors to talk politics. That requires candidates to do something different. They can't simply rely on high-level media campaigns, blowing a lot of money on television, and not getting onto the ground and actually talking to real voters. The caucus kind of requires the candidates connect at a much more direct level, on top of which Iowa, as a relatively low population state, facilitates that. I commented at one point to a friend of mine that, you know, Iowa is one place where a presidential candidate could literally shake the hand of everyone who will caucus for him or her. And you just can't do that in larger states. So that's a piece of it. And the fact that Iowa is first means that you've got literally years of attention paid to what's going on in Iowa and paid to the candidates, which means the rest of the country learns something about the candidates by what goes on the ground in Iowa.
Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email if you'd like to comment with your thoughts on the Iowa caucuses. David is another David is with us in Muscatine. David, welcome to our program. David left our program. We still have, fortunately, David Redlosk with us as well. David wanted to talk about participating in a caucus and exactly the point that you were on there. So when we talk about caucuses, can we look back at 08 or earlier campaign cycles and point to candidates that got it, that got this difference between a caucus and a primary and those who didn't? Carolyn.
I think that the 208 caucuses hold important lessons for the candidates in 212. On the Republican side, Mitt Romney outspent all of his Republican counterparts, and he lost to Mike Huckabee in the caucuses. Romney largely ran a mass media campaign, spending heavily on radio and television. It wasn't a successful strategy for winning in the Iowa caucuses.
So was this more attuned to a primary, you'd say?
It would be a primary strategy.
Yeah.
In contrast, Obama outspent his fellow Democratic counterparts, Hillary Clinton and John Edwards, but he spent his money on grassroots campaigning, and this meant field offices, door-to-door canvassing, in-person phone calls, as well as a campaign fought over the airways. In the surveys that Dave Redlosk and I ran of Iowa caucus participants, our data shows that more people reported being contacted by an Obama supporter in person, in mail, and the phone than any other of the Democratic candidates. So he reached more people using the grassroots ground game. So we argue that grassroots politics, where candidates meet voters, where people are convinced to actually caucus via a face-to-face contact or not a robocall, but an actual person on the telephone, is really critical to winning Iowa.
I remember the 08 caucus, observing that at an elementary school and seeing arriving to observe it and seeing just a huge number of Hillary Clinton supporters with signs, even sandwiches and so forth, barely a presence of the Obama outwardly. Once you got in there, that's when the momentum started. So that was interesting, I thought, is that it looked like Hillary Clinton was out in force during the caucuses, but you're saying not in the right way, perhaps.
It when we look at the Clinton campaign, there is a sense that they never quite got it, and they did try to make up for it at the end. It was well publicized that she was catering in sandwiches all over the state, for example, as if somehow that would make up for not doing enough door knocking, not doing enough personal contact. The Obama campaign got it early, and you know, they really will be the epitome of how you do a Democratic caucus campaign going forward. One thing worth pointing out that Carolyn was mentioning our data that's really kind of fascinating is we find in the data very few Republican voters indicating that they were reached by door knocking, and lots of Democrats. There's a real difference in the way Republicans and Democrats run their campaigns. And I think part of it, in the case of Huckabee winning in Iowa, he didn't have the money, he didn't actually have the field organization, but he had groups, he had churches and pastors and people kind of behind the scenes talking to each other, reaching out to each other, say, we've got a caucus for this guy. While Mitt Romney was running the more traditional primary, as we've said, media campaign, And it's fascinating because every cycle somebody does that. You could, you know, you could ask President Forbes how well that worked for him a few cycles back, right?
Right.
It's just, you know, seems like the lessons have to be learned over and over by the candidates.
Neither Romney nor Huckabee won the nomination, the Republican nomination. It was, of course, John McCain. So what does that say about the Iowa caucuses for the Republicans? Are there differences in the way the two parties approach the caucuses? Do they mean different things? Carolyn?
Well, we actually argue that Mike Huckabee was a spoiler. And so what he did was he ruined Romney's chances. So Romney went into the New Hampshire primary weakened. Romney was supposed to win Iowa and see instead of beating the media expectations, he did worse than the media expectations. And so we argue that that opened the window for a change. Dave, do you?
Yeah, and in fact, Romney was absolutely the most mentioned Republican candidate in the pre-caucus in terms of the media. But in post-caucus, it didn't get him anywhere. I mean, all the focus was on how badly he had done. And that, we think, really did kind of fatally injure him. So while Huckabee wasn't really likely, honestly, to go very far after Iowa, given his lack of money and the nature of his campaign, you know, this just opened the door for McCain, who was never really anybody's first choice. But Iowa, in that case, kind of weeded things out on the Republican side.
And part of what is so interesting about this and which state goes first is that if New Hampshire's primary was first, if Iowa didn't exist, the hypothetical, no mm-hmm. Iowa caucus, we start with New Hampshire primary. I think it's very likely that Romney and Clinton would have been the two nominees in 2008. And the fact that we had McCain and Obama, we really can in some ways credit to Iowa. And I think that's part of what we're trying to argue. Another lesson that I think is interesting for the candidates in 212 is mobilizing turnout. Now, there's lots of ways that we can talk about turnout. If we just look at registered voters in Iowa, and that means that independents, they can still caucus for the Democratic or the Republican Party on each night, but oftentimes they don't. And that's a big group. That's about a third of the population. But if we just look at turnout of registered voters in Iowa, on average, it's 6% of Iowans. So finding somebody who will get out of their comfy chair, as Dave says, and caucus is like finding a needle in a haystack. Turnout of registered voters in 208 in the Iowa caucuses was 12%. It was double. It was double the average turnout. And remarkably, our survey data shows that 50% of the people who caucused in 208 were first-timers. They had never caucused before. This meant that caucus attenders in 208 were younger, less educated, less affluent, and much more moderate in their positions, and there were many more independents. So another lesson is mobilizing turnout of getting people to actually caucus who are your supporters. And this is why the grassroots face-to-face kind of mobilization is so critical.
And let me quick, that wasn't all Obama, these first-timers. There were lots of Hillary Clinton first-timers as well. But even more interesting, there were nearly as large a percentage of the Republican caucusers were also first-timers. And in many cases, that was a Huckabee kind of social networking effect, I guess we could call it.
David Redlawsk with us, Carolyn Tolbert. They are two of the co-authors of a new book titled Why Iowa? How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. Join our conversation. Also, listeners from out of state are welcome to give us their opinions. Illinois, Missouri, Nebraska, Minnesota, let us know your thoughts about Iowa being in the leadoff status for the caucuses and such an important factor when we come around to the next election cycle. 1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Kirk is in Iowa City. Good afternoon, Kirk. Welcome to the exchange.
Hello. Great to be on the show. I had an interesting point. I'm a independent, and last election was my first caucus, so your point was well made there. But what I've noticed is I've talked to a lot of people from all over the country, also a lot of people from outside of the country. And when you talk to people in America, if they're not from Iowa, they say, oh, yeah, Iowa, that's a state, right? I mean, I flew over it once. Yeah, don't you have corn? Do you have plumbing? You know, like, they have no idea. But if you talk to anyone outside of America, they say, wow, Iowa, that's the caucus state, right? You go, isn't that exciting? It's great. And they're so excited about it, whereas the people in the country don't seem to care until a month before it happens, and then they forget again.
Interesting point of view there, Kirk. So let's talk a little bit about that. The Iowa caucuses do form people's ideas about Iowa in the meantime, in the last 30 years, 30, 40 years, in a big way, don't they? Yes, David.
Yeah, no, I absolutely. The international thing is especially fascinating because I was traveling internationally before the 2008 general election, and lots of people at Iowa, the Iowa caucuses, tell me what happened. How did that work? What, you know, how did Obama win in Iowa when it's all white? You know, these kinds of things that were just really interesting. We always have international TV and media coming into Iowa, and you know, in the last cycle, I don't know how many interviews I did with international folks. So there's tremendous interest, and I think there's some truth to Kirk's point that within the country, this is something that's very episodic, and people, as you know, to pay attention to it relatively close to the time. But that's an important point nonetheless, that people do pay attention to what happens in Iowa. Part of what we show in the book that is new in our understanding of the role of the caucuses is just how being aware of what happens in Iowa conditions what people think about the candidates, how viable, how electable they are. So Kirk's right. I think most of the country isn't that aware of Iowa. When I moved there originally from New Jersey, and now I'm back in New Jersey, most of my friends were, Iowa, is that like the place where they do potatoes? So, you know,
we're used to that, aren't we, David?
Exactly.
Let's try to squeeze in a caller before we have to take a break. David is in Iowa City. Another David. David, can you hear us? Sounds like you're maybe on the road, huh?
I'm sorry. I can hear you fine. I hope you can hear me.
Yes, go ahead. We have very quickly, please.
Why Iowa's status as first is allowed to continue? Why don't other states force themselves earlier? Why do the national party organizations allow it to continue, or why do they want it this way?
David, good. We'll get a quick answer before our break from let's go to Carolyn on this one.
That's a big question that we ask in the book. The entire back half of the book looks at potential reforms of the presidential nomination process. And we definitely, opinion polls will show us that large majorities of Americans favor reform of the process. And in fact, polls consistently show about 70% of Americans favor a national primary. What we argue actually in the book, though, is that there are benefits to the current system that may not be widely known. And if you take a look at our book, we actually, the conclusion recommends a very novel reform option that combines a national primary with Iowa's caucus.
We have to take a short break. We'll be right back with our guests, Carolyn Talbert, David Redlawsk, co-authors of a new book, Why Iowa, How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. Also, when we come back, J. Ann Seltzer, president of Seltzer & Company, a public opinion research company based in Des Moines, will turn some of our focus, at least, to polling when we come back. And we'd like your opinion as well. 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, as we discuss the Iowa caucuses as we get into the 2012 caucus campaigning season. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, examining the Iowa caucuses, their history, their significance, and the strategies various candidates have used over the years. And my guests, continuing on from the first half hour, they are the co-authors, two of the three co-authors of the new book, Why Iowa, How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. David Redlawsk, joining us by phone, political science professor at Rutgers University, formerly of the University of Iowa. Carolyn Talbert, professor of political science at the University of Iowa currently. And we want to reach out to our listeners, ask your thoughts about the Iowa caucuses and about polling this hour, how that influences you, your experiences with polling. 1-866-780-9100, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Also joining us for this half hour, J. Ann Selzer, president of Selzer & Company, a public opinion research company based in Des Moines. The most anticipated poll of Iowa caucus season seems to be the Selzer poll right before the caucus. It successfully predicted Obama's win in 2008. Ann Selzer, welcome to our program.
Good afternoon.
She joins us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. Tell us how the polling works during the Iowa caucuses.
Well, I have to tell you, if you listed out the specifications for polling likely caucus goers on paper and showed it to a pollster, they would say it can't be done. It's very difficult for some of the reasons that your guests mentioned. It's a very
needle
low
in the haystack
incident.
Is what
it's,
was said. Yes.
Scientifically, we call that a low incidence event. That is, yes. Not that many people show up. So just finding people who will look like a cross section of the people who will show up on caucus night. Very difficult, and by that I mean very expensive.
Okay, so how do you do that? Can you give us a quick view of how you do that, even though it is complicated?
It is complicated, and you know, we've been successful. So in the back of my mind, even though I'm daunted, I think, well, it can be done. So that helps. You know, we work with the registered voter database as our starting point, which has some pluses and has some minuses. It's currently working for us, and we just ask, how likely is it that you will attend a caucus on caucus night? So we tend to take a more simplistic approach. It's just the amount of man hours that go into hanging up on all those people who have no intention of caucusing, and then having some tools built into your questionnaire so you can really divine the most likely participants from those who may say they're going but are maybe a little bit less likely to actually show.
David and Carolyn, you were director and co-director of the University of Iowa Hawkeye poll from 2006 to 2009. Anything to add to that on how you find that needle in the haystack, that small percentage of people who actually will go out and then get a representative sample, David?
And you know, it's exactly right, of course. And of course, the Iowa poll has done a tremendous job on caucus polling. It's really the one of record. The approach we took was very similar, although for various reasons we were working from primarily from random digit dialing, which is even harder than working from the voter list, but it did allow us to pick up people who are not registered voters but who, in fact, show up at caucus. And there were a number of them this time around, just given what happened with the caucuses. But even so, you know, there are two pieces. One is the finding them, and then the other is essentially guessing what caucus turnout is going to look like, because they're, you know, each caucus is different. And I think before the 2008 caucus, I was just saying to people, oh, about 160,000 Democrats will show up, maybe 180,000 as we got closer. And of course, mm-hmm. It was 240,000, and it did change the demographics.
Right. Let me share this email from Joanne, one of our listeners, yeah, who emailed us and follow up with a question. Joanne writes, I've been participating in caucuses since I moved to Iowa in 1978. During highly contested years, it has become more and more difficult to actually run the caucus. Mm-hmm. She was a chair in her precinct in 2008. It was very difficult that year, she writes, because there were too many people for the room and too little understanding by most people there about what the process really entails. The idea is great, she writes, but the precincts are too large for times when a lot of people want to participate. Joanne writing that. This is also, what did you say, 16% of the people, registered voters participating. That's a huge turnout. Did the Iowa poll, Ann Selzer, I know correctly said Obama was going to win the caucus, but did it also predict the large turnout? I guess I'm being corrected. 12%, 12%, right?
We did, actually, and this was one of the ways that we were beat up before the actual caucus night for our poll. That is, we said that there would be a high number of people on the Democratic side participating for the first time. I think our number was 60%. The entrance polls that were done by the networks ended up saying it was 59. So we felt pretty good, but people said, good heavens, her turnout model is predicting this unprecedented large number of turnout on caucus night, and how can she make that assumption? To which I had just had to answer, look, our data tells us. We assume nothing. Our data tells us that this is what we can expect. And in fact, we were very close with that.
I should mention that that earlier numbers we gave of 6% and 12% turnout, that's the 18 and over population in Iowa, not of registered voters. So these numbers that Ann just mentioned, which are much higher, is because that's based off from registered voters. And Ann, I'm not sure, are those actually registered partisans? And
so, well, no, this is the 60% number is people who said this would be their first caucus. Okay. So that's not an incidence rate at all, but just that the majority of people in the room, as the emailer was mentioning, this was their first time. They don't know how the system works. They have to be taught. It's a complicated process, more complicated on the Democratic side than on the Republican side. But yes, those precincts were overrun by a huge number of people showing up for the first time. And caucuses, unlike primaries, you know, you have to have everybody in the same room at the same time.
David, it sounds like you want to comment.
Well, I'll give you I ran the caucus in my precinct all through from when I got there, basically, starting with 2000 through 2008. In the 2000 presidential, my precinct in Iowa City had about 115 people show up. In the 2004, we had about 380, 390. It's the same precinct. And we prepared for 2008 for about 450, and we had 570. This is in a small gym in an elementary school. It was, I think Joanne's right, it does make it extraordinarily difficult to run a caucus as we conceive of them, particularly on the Democratic side. The Republicans, it's much simpler because they actually cast a vote, and they report the votes. And so on the Republican side, even a large caucus, I think, is much more manageable. Democrats, because Democrats stand up publicly, move around the room, cajole each other and argue and what have you, these very large caucuses have the risk of really losing, you know, the inherent basis of the caucus, which is people being able to talk a little bit about politics.
1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org, talking about caucuses, Iowa's first in the nation status, also about polling that has to do with caucuses. 1-866-780-9100. Kathy has been waiting in Iowa City. What's on your mind, Kathy?
Well, I guess I could roll this two questions into one by saying I've been taking polls with a grain of salt in the last maybe decade, because you could get a hold of me at my home, because I've lived here a long time and I tend to answer the phone. But I wonder what problem you have getting a representative sample when young people, all the young people I know, have cell phones and no landline at all. And a lot of other people, even my age, have caller ID and won't pick up a phone if they don't know who that caller is.
Okay,
so
let's turn that perhaps to Ann Selzer. Of course, the cell phone steadily displacing landlines. How do you deal with that?
Well, these are all the things we worry about. And by worry about, I mean we think up ways for how it is that we're going to address them, how we're going to be inclusive, how we're going to manage to do it. And I think, you know, for me and for people who do election polling, you know, our feet are held to the fire. We find out whether, in fact, we can draw a representative sample once there is an election, once there is a caucus. I mean, we're proved up or we're thrown out. So we're able to get a reasonable substitute for all of those people who won't be available, who won't pick up their phone if there's caller ID. We're getting enough people who are similar enough to them that we end up with the right cross-section. Otherwise, we couldn't do what we do with any accuracy whatsoever, and yet we are incredibly accurate for now. But we worried about tomorrow.
What about push polling? Because that's a technique in which an individual organization attempts to influence or alter the view of respondents under the guise of conducting a poll. How has that affected real polling? Made people suspicious, Ann?
You know, I would think, I have to tell you, I think there's less push polling going on than people think there is. A regular poll is about data gathering. A push poll is about data dissemination. So they're going to call a huge number of people because they want to infect the largest number of people. And a regular poll is going to call a selected sample. You can kind of hear it happening, you know, as it's going on. It's an attempt to disseminate bad information about the opposition, typically.
So how can I determine, how can everyone listening, they will be the subject of polls, being called for polls and push polls, how do you quickly determine whether you've got the real deal or someone trying to influence your opinion?
Well, the most common way that people do a push poll is to, first of all, they don't want to spend a lot of time because they want to talk to a lot of people. So they're going to get right into the dirt very quickly. And the question will be, well, would it make a difference if you knew such and such?
Mm-hmm. They're adding some information that's obviously going to skew it.
That's right. That's right. And they'll ask a question up front about who you support. And they obviously, if you're supporting the wrong person or the person they're campaigning for, they're going to get rid of you because you're already on their side. So they're just sort of ways that you can hear that they're in the dirt about it. A regular campaign poll will test negatives on the opposition, but you will hear it in a balanced way. They will test negatives about their own candidate, too. And there'll be demographic information that they'll collect from you at the end, typically. So that sort of is what a normal poll is. But people confuse and think anytime you've asked negative questions, that's a push poll. But they're two very different things.
I know, Anne, people who hate polls so much that when they are called by a pollster, deliberately give wrong answers to try to sabotage the polling. Is this a problem you consider?
For now, it hasn't been a problem that we couldn't deal with. I mean, for now, for every one of those people who is giving a bad answer on one side, we've got somebody giving a bad answer on the right side.
I see. They balance each other's out, you think.
We couldn't be accurate if this was a big problem. That's my point.
Okay, let's...
And we are accurate.
Talking about the caucuses and polling, those two going hand in hand in this show for our purposes today, 1-866-780-9100. Jay has been waiting in West Point, and this is in Iowa, not in Annapolis, right, Jay?
No, there's also West Point, Illinois, too. So
West Point, Illinois, very good.
Yeah, not too far over the river either, yeah.
What's on your mind, Jay?
Hey, I just first off got to congratulate on the poll because, like the last three caucuses, you've been right on the money, and I watched the national shows. Oh, it can't be right. Yes, the Des Moines Register is the gold standard, and they got our state totally. It's amazing how good they are. So anyway, what I want to say, it was thrilling about walking in that caucus room and seeing more people in the other five times I went than I've ever seen. And then, I went to the Democratic one, but I also heard the Republicans had an all-time in our Lee County where I live. And what I was going to say was we do need some reforms probably, but first off, the strong points of our state is that you can't just use a mass carpet, mass media. That's not going to work here. You can put all the ads on TV you want, all the other crap. It's not going to – radio might help a little, but you got to talk to people. That's what they're like saying with Palin, too. You actually have to take the questions and not flinch. And Obama's strong point from what I saw, and I went to Hillary's and Edwards, too, he actually did the town hall meetings, and he had an index card, and he, talked to the – or congratulated the local dignitary, mayor or whatever, and then he went right to the people and took the questions, and he wasn't reading off teleprompters or any of this lying crap. But anyway, what I was going to say, the reforms that they might need to do is maybe have it on a Saturday. I think that's better than a nighttime. I just feel like the turnout was not unmanageable. Like I said, I saw twice the number of people.
Okay.
But they did handle it really well.
Jay, thank you. Let's bat that around a little bit, perhaps reforms in the Iowa caucus. Are there ideas there? Because this ties it really in with the part of your book, David and Carolyn, talking about the sequential nature of the nominating process, the benefits and challenges of this. Talk about that. Why not just have a national primary on one day so that no state feels advantaged or slighted?
One of the things that is very important that about a sequential system where you have elections spaced between the states is that the citizenry can really learn. They're watching Iowa. They're looking at who did better than expected, who did worse than expected. And the sequential nature of the election system creates information that's transferred. And there's a learning process, basically, across the states. One thing about Iowa that's unique is just how many candidates there are. Dave, was it 16 candidates in 208 on the...
Yeah. In that at one point or another, there were at least 16 candidates across the two parties.
Mm-hmm.
It's an opportunity, really, for not just Iowans, but because of the media environment that we're in, for the whole country to see these folks early on to see them as they're trying to develop their messages, as they're trying to develop their campaigns. And it puts a real premium on organizing and the ability to organize, which we think not only stands candidates in good stead going forward in the primaries, but matters in the general election. I mean, one reason that Obama did so well in Iowa in the general election is his organization never went away, where McCain never really had an organization in Iowa. So, you know, there are a number of good arguments in favor of this sequential process, and particularly starting in a relatively small state where candidates are forced to talk to people because they otherwise won't. One potential outcome of a national primary are tarmac campaigns. Candidates fly into a city, stand on the tarmac, say something for the local media, and fly out again. And, of course, pure media campaigns. On the other hand, you know, people do make the argument, and I think legitimately so, that in a normal year, which for the Democrats 2008 wasn't, an awful lot of states don't get very much to say about what happens. And for the Republicans, McCain had essentially wrapped it up Super Tuesday, and the states that came after that had no choice. So you're trying to balance these two things, everybody, every voter that cares having an opportunity to have something to say versus a system that allows candidates and voters to develop over time.
Our final minutes with David Redlosk, Carolyn Talbert, and Ann Selzer. Before the time does get away, of course, an interesting factor we'll have this time, 2012, in this campaign season, up to the caucuses just over a year from now, the Tea Party. I'd like to get your comments, each of you, about you think the effect of the Tea Party on the Iowa caucus, on polling, how you are adjusting or thinking about that added element here. Let me start with you, Ann Selzer.
Well, you know, the Des Moines Register Iowa poll, we were one of the first in the country to actually measure people's support for the Tea Party. And I think there was a certain amount of jaw-dropping shock when we reported out that about 1 in 3 Iowans say that, in fact, they do support the Tea Party. So this is not a fringe element as it had been portrayed in the national media. There is something here that is attractive to people, and it's pulling them in. Now, how that will play out in terms of caucus organizing, I think it will be very interesting to see. I know Newt Gingrich is sort of mentioned as maybe he's going to be in, maybe he isn't going to be in. I just recently read a biography published in 95 where one of the chapters kind of was familiar in terms of laying out what looks like the modern day Tea Party movement. So I think there are elements of this that are going to be part of every candidate's campaign because you just cannot ignore 1 in 3 Iowans.
Carolyn, a comment about the Tea Party before we close this show.
I think that the nature of the caucuses, the nature of the social networks, the grassroots mobilization means that Tea Party leaning candidates may be more successful in the Iowa caucuses than we might have seen even in the 210 elections, the congressional elections, just given. But it obviously depends on what Tea Party leaning Republican candidates will be running.
David, what else can you tell us about the nature of the 2012 caucus season, how it may be different than we've experienced before?
Well, it certainly overall won't be as exciting as 2008 just because it's only one party, the Republicans and not the Democrats, presumably. On the other hand, I think there'll be a lot of excitement within the Republican Party. There certainly are potentially an awful lot of candidates, both really well-known and unknown. I guess to some degree it's going to be more of the same, I think, still. It means that the candidates that best organize, that best figure out the ground game, that best make those social connections that need to be made are the ones who are the most likely to beat expectations and go forward.
And Dave, one thing that we should highlight is that to win in Iowa doesn't necessarily mean having the most money. And that's the thing about the Iowa caucuses, because it's a grassroots ground game. Candidates who are not the best financed can have a chance.
Quickly, before we have to go, do you foresee any change in Iowa's status, first in the nation? Will that possibly change at any time in the future?
You know, who knows at any time. Right now, both parties have reaffirmed Iowa's leadoff position for 2012, and I think the best you can hope is to take it one election at a time.
Okay, what are the factors in favor of keeping it the way it is, Carolyn?
I would say that the political parties have an investment in keeping it the way it is because they've played the game and they want to keep the rules the way it is. I would say the media has an investment. The mass media has an investment in keeping it the way it is because they've come in droves to Iowa in January and they have a lot of coverage as the sequential process unfolds. So I would say I don't see a change in the imminent future.
Very quickly, David, we have to go.
Yeah, no, really quickly. The other thing is who else would go first? You'd have the other 49 states fighting over that, so they might as well leave it alone.
Okay, David Redlosk, Carolyn Talbert, co-authors of Why Iowa, a new book, and Ann Selzer with us, president of Selzer & Company. Ann, Carolyn, and David, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thanks, Ben.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
The Exchange is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins, production assistants today, from Christina Sarnelli, technical support from Dennis Reese in Des Moines, help from John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, is Jeff Schmidt. We always welcome your comments and questions. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is the email where you can get a hold of us. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.